Hello, everyone. This is Sophia Smallstorm, and I have a new podcast today. I have a sort of a spotty timing with these. I'll do two or three at once, and then there'll be a big lull, and usually it has to do with something technical. Of course, in this world of internet recording, there are some people who don't want us to succeed with our plans to interview very deep and wonderful people. And I have such a person for you today, and I really mean that. He's laughing already. I told him he wasn't allowed to do this. But he is someone who's got a massive number of talents, and he has won awards and recognition in lots of different fields, and he'll probably mention a couple of his other kinds of activities that he's recognized for. But we know him as an alternative writer, journalist, researcher, and he has a particular niche now, assassinations. I'm going to keep you kind of hanging if you haven't guessed who it is already. But anyway, I like our guest today because he is a very unusually deep, soulful human being. And you can hear that in his voice. You can hear that he is in this with and through his heart. And that's what I find so absolutely admirable. So my hat goes off to Ole Damegaard. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Sophia. I feel really touched by this introduction.
Well, it's true. I mean, the first time I heard you, I thought, wow, who is this? Because you were talking out of your soul. You care. You know, you're not just an expert. You care.
Do you know, I think facts without feelings doesn't make a difference. You really have to come from your heart, otherwise it's useless. You can be really very knowledgeable in an area, but if there's no caring, then what good does it do you? Sometimes knowledge can even hurt other people, you know, and damage environment and whatever. I mean, these people that are controlling the world, they're very knowledgeable and very intelligent, but look what they're doing. So I really try to come from the heart and do what I'm supposed to do on this earth.
Yes. And I think what you just told me in our pre-interview chat, that you actually have a specialty in a certain kind of yoga and what yoga really means. Do you want to tell the audience about that? Because that, I think, is one reason why you are doing this in such an integrated way.
What you're talking about is Raja Yoga, Raya Yoga or Raja Yoga, and that is the science of the mind. This is the original yoga, 5,000-6,000 year old, and it's the science of the mind. And the word yoga actually means union, union with you and your source. Whatever that is, whatever word you want to call it. And what most people confuses with the word yoga is that they think it's all these postures and so on. And that is yoga as well, but it's just one small part of yoga, the so-called hatha yoga, which is to get your body in a state that it will not disturb you while you meditate or while you try to get in contact with the source, with where Raja Yoga is the center. So there's, I'm very blessed to have met a wonderful, wonderful teacher called Melanie Chelaram. And through her, I've been able to take all my 30 years plus of research when it comes into these very, very dark areas like assassinations, conspiracies, terror acts, and so on. But come from a point where I used to approach it with fear or paranoia, to change the direction and enter this very dark area, but to the heart and with the intention of love, compassion, and forgiveness. And this is a way that really speaks to my soul, that really resonates with me. And it also makes me fearless in approaching these very dark forces, because this is, it's shit scary, because you get into a minefield where you're up against forces or people or groups that are normally very violent in their way of solving problems. I mean, they eliminate people, they assassinate people, they blow up people right, left, and center. So it's a very scary area if you're not totally grounded and centered. And I for me, Raja Yoga has been a beautiful way of just passing that fear stage and enter it with the intention of love, compassion, forgiveness, and these beautiful, in my world, very beautiful ethics that will help to heal this planet and take it to the next level, which I think will be an absolutely astounding new world that will appear once we transcend this obstacle.
Now, Ole, when you do this yoga, how can people look it up? Can you just spell it for us so that people can Google it and learn a little more?
It's Raja Yoga, R-A-J-A Yoga.
Raja
it's the yoga. It's the basic, that is the core of what yoga is. It was not made as a great workout and my God, look, I can get my legs behind my head and something like that. That was not the intention with yoga. The intention was for you to get in touch with your source, whatever that is, if you want to call it God or whatever it is, but to get past from your heart to the source and not let the mind interfere. And the normal yoga is to calm your body down so that you will not be disturbed by that, by aches and pains and toxics and so on. So I'm stiff like a log, so I'm not, when it comes to normal yoga, I'm the worst. But Raja Yoga really speaks to me.
Well,
and
that's very
cool. I just want to... If I can just say this, if you want to go to a website, it's called yogagibraltar.com, yogagibraltar.com.
Like the Rock Gibraltar, yogagibraltar.com,
okay. Or you can go on YouTube and you can find Melanie, that's N-A-L-A-N-I-E, Chelaram, that's C-H-E-L-L-A-R-A-M. Nalani Chelaram. She is absolutely astounding, this woman. I feel so blessed to have had her as my teacher. She walks her talk 100%. She does everything for free. It's only a matter of giving. And I've seen her, you know, personally, I've been very close to her through all types of awful, awful situations, good and bad. Deaths in a family, several deaths, and I've seen her how to deal with them, how to go through these very dark times, and she's just astounding, this woman. So I can totally recommend listening to her. I filmed about 200 hours of her talks that she gives totally for free all over the world, and I put them up on YouTube. So if you just go Melanie Chelaram, you will find her, and the knowledge that she spreads is just beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Well, thank you. Now, her name begins with M like Michael or N like Nancy?
Nancy.
Okay, I heard M. Okay, so N-A-L-A-N-I-E.
A-L-A-N-I-E, okay. Melanie. It's quite an unusual name, so I think just by putting her first name in, you should get in touch with or find a playlist where all of these talks are. These talks will help you through whatever dark things you're going through, up, down, left, right, whatever it is. She approaches so many different areas of life.
Now, you have really passed the buck. I gave you accolades and you just gave them to her. So that's good. That's what it's about. So thank you, and I'm sure people will be very interested and perhaps even helped by this direction that you've given us. But I'm wondering now, you mentioned earlier, and I kind of snagged that because I've heard you talk this way before, that you're approaching this dark matter, subject matter, with light and forgiveness and love. And so I really want to ask you personally, Ole, you are willing to forgive the perpetrators for all the things that they're doing or have done?
I tell you, without lying, I don't feel anger against them. I don't feel hatred. I really mean that. I'm not sure how I come to this point, but I do want them to absolutely stop. What they're up to and what they've done for such a long time is so not okay. It's totally horrendous, awful atrocities, murders, all of these things. But I just feel I'm not here to point blaming fingers. It's just like they say in the old scripts and so on, judge the sin, not the sinner. Many of these people do not know what they're doing. They've been tricked and fooled and duped into situations where they're committing all of these atrocities. And I just say, it is the main thing is that this madness stops. Whatever it takes, just make it stop, you know. And it is by exposing the truth that is where healing can take place. And I think like the Truth and Reconciliation Committee in South Africa, where former people from the apartheid regime came forward totally in transparency, met their victims and so on. That was where, when they were totally open and without defense, without all these shields or so on, when they met, that was where real forgiveness could take place, and where now I've seen beautiful examples of how former enemies are now working side by side. And it's the same, it's only by compassion and forgiveness that we can move forward, because otherwise, in my opinion, if we meet these so-called awful people that have done these awful atrocities with violence, with revenge, with hatred, it will just continue. If we do so-called revolutions, we get them. I mean, they're only a few thousand when you look at it, so it shouldn't be so difficult for billions of us to just say, stop, we've had it. Chop the head of them and get on with life. If we do that, if you study history, you will see that every single time, as far as I know, the people who have chopped the head of former dictators have just turned even worse in a few years down the line. So that is not the way to go.
So you mean
the way to go is
okay.
The way to go in my world is to transcend this whole thing. Transcend it. And that is true forgiveness, compassion, to meet this without hatred, totally fearless. I'm not talking about being a wimp and saying yeah. I'm talking about standing up side by side, brothers and sisters, and just said, we have had enough. It is enough. You have to stop this, and we will see to it that you will stop.
Okay.
We will not use forceful. We will not bend.
Okay, so I'm just going to speak literally now. If we stand up as a body of unity and say, you have to stop, what if they don't? Because in the final, at the end of the day, they are the ones who run the law enforcement. And I see how there's a pyramid, how there is ultimate control at the top, and then there are layers and layers and layers of people. And in each of those layers, I understand now that there is a pyramid also. There are people at the top who kind of know a lot more than the rank and file people through that department or agency. But when we talk about the assassins that you have researched, they may be very well programmed people under programming, and they are tricked and duped and made into robotic executors of other people's desires and designs. But how do we approach, how do we go through the pyramid when the agencies that regulate us are all part of that pyramidic structure, and they have the money and they have the tanks and they have the brawn behind them? So this is what I'm trying to get at with you.
Sophia, I have absolutely no idea.
Okay.
What I do know is that I have no solution. I have no idea how this is going to happen, but I know it will happen. My intention, and maybe I'll die totally, you know, without having accomplished it, my intention is that I will continue until there's total peace, total harmony, total ceasefire, no wars going on. And one of my friends, a former CIA whistleblower, a former assassin, his name is Chip Tatum, he said that that sounded like a Miss America speech. I can totally agree with that. Does not matter. This is my intention. How it's going to happen, I have no idea. I'm just one single person. I have no idea. But what I do know is that in your heart, whoever you are, the truth is still the truth. You know in your heart when you do something that is right and when you do something that is wrong. You know when you torture somebody or when you kill somebody or when you hurt someone else, you know in your heart, maybe your ego will get a boost of it and a rush of power, whatever it is that gives the kick for these people, I don't know. But in your heart, behind all of this, you know this is no good. And it's by tricking to get this spark going, to get it to get recognized, to see beyond this screaming face that is trying to bash your head in or trying to scare you into disobedience.
Ole, we got interrupted by a little bit of Skype interference and our call crashed. But you were just about to explain, or you were advising us, which I think many of us know, that we are completely controlled by fear and that you do not know how we're going to get to the stage where this is going to come to a halt. But you believe that, I think you're a very committed person in this. It's almost like this is part of your being. You're now doing your dharma, as they call it, in these interviews and the writings, the research, and that's what's so unusual about you. You are so committed, and you know in your being, that's what I'm hearing from you, that this is going to go in another direction eventually. Right? I mean, I'm just using a general term.
I don't know where it comes from. I just know it. You know, I know that we're okay. I know we're fine. And I know it looks so scary. And I have no solutions. I have no answers. I just know that we will be fine. And like you mentioned, they try to control us through fear. Fear is their major tool. And one of the ways they get to us is through media, through this black box and through the newspapers and so on. That is how they grab you by the throat and push you down into fear and despair and all of these things. I would say that it's very important to become aware that dangers are real. There are such things as dangers, for sure. But fear is only in the mind. Fear is only in the mind. It's nothing, something that you can touch. Fear is only created in the mind, and that is where you can learn to control it or exchange it with another feeling. The feeling I would try and exchange with is love. Love is the one that works for me. And when, for instance, if I'm in a dangerous situation, I've been in war zones, I've been in different places where people say, my God, you can get killed and so on. I can totally agree with that. But the thing is that what I try to do is that if you got this, for instance, a police officer that wants to bash your head in or somebody who really wants to hurt you or something like that, if you can, instead of getting fearful of this screaming face in front of you or this somebody who's aiming a weapon at you or something like that, instead of getting fearful, because then you're in totally in that person's ball game. They have got you. If you get fearful, that's where they want you. So if you can, the only thing you can do in that situation is in your mind. But that is where the whole magic happens, if I'm right. If you can focus your mind, the word that works for me is divine. Divine, divine, divine. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's somebody's brother. He's somebody's sister. He's somebody's father. He's divine. He's divine, divine, divine. That keeps my mind on track. It does not allow me to get off into fear mode. Once I'm if I get really scared, I've lost it. You know, I've lost my grounding. I make awful decisions. I just run around like a headless chicken. Does not do anyone good. So I try to focus my mind on that one. Divine, 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 divine. And just that will keep my mind in a loving state. I don't see that person as a threat. I don't see him as a monster. I don't see him as a... And something, I have no idea what it is, but something miraculously happened. And it just diffuses the situation. I've seen it happen so many times where some situation that looks very dangerous somehow diffuses. This man or person gets very confused that you do not get scared of him. Why don't you get freaked out when I'm going to blow your brains out or something like that? And it diffuses it. And then down a few minutes down the line or half an hour down the line, suddenly you're sitting talking like friends.
Well, what you're describing sounds to me like a form of neuro-linguistic programming that you figured out to apply in such a situation. And by saying the word divine, which becomes your sort of key word, mantra, in a very scary situation. And, you know, here's another reason why you're special. You have been in the hurricane more than once as a journalist. You have this background as a professional journalist, along with some other things that you'll probably tell us about later, author, artist, musician. So, yeah, the journalist, the being in the storm, and then calling up this neuro-linguistic magical term, because that's what it does. It changes your neurochemistry, and you don't feel that fear because now you're relying on something that has its own effect on you that you've probably used before many, many times. So you have kind of a safe place to go, and when you're looking at that the beast with his shotgun ready to blow your brains out, what you're doing is outside of his language, right? Because he's not seeing the reaction he's been trained to see. And so his power is lost because he doesn't know what to do next.
I don't know. That sounds like a very scientific explanation. I have no idea. It could be spot on. I've just seen that it creates miracles. It's like, just like you say, what are they going to do if they cannot scare you? What are they going to do if you're not afraid of getting killed? What can they do? It's like, what can they do? You take away the force from them. They think that just because they can walk around in bulletproof vest and look like Robocop and, you know, like have bulletproof underpants or whatever they have, that will make them a greater, more powerful being than you. But it doesn't. It's the other way around. You can stand there totally defenseless, but totally centered in the highest frequency, which is love, and this diffuse this very dangerous situation. I tell you, I've seen it, like I said, in war zones. I have not been a journalist. I've not been paid to go to these situation. I've done that on my own. I took a bicycle from Sweden heading for South Africa many years ago on my own, ended up in the war-torn Iran-Iraq war, and in the end I smuggled out people from there. I've been in very dangerous situation, and I've seen this beauty of the power of love. I'm not talking about love like I fancy you, baby, that type of love, being in love or falling in love. Totally different type of thing. I'm talking about what the frequency that is the highest one in the universe. It's higher than a frequency of thought. It's the frequency that can make a mother lift off a car off her child in a car accident, or make a father just jump into a house in flames to bring out his child or something. That power that is just, it breaks all rules. And I've seen beautiful experiments in laboratories where they've had a very high frequency and a very low frequency. And in this universe, one of the highest or the highest one is the one we call love, and one of the lowest one or the lowest one is pure terror, pure fear. When you let a high frequency and a low frequency meet, it's not that they suddenly start, they meet and then they start struggling in the middle, and in the end you get sort of like, the winner is the one somewhere in the middle. No, what happens is that the lower frequency just gets annulled. It disappears. And I believe that this small so-called elite group, I prefer calling them the lightless or the minority, that they're very aware of this, and that's why they try to push us down, push your head down in the dirt to get you down where they can control you. Because they are very aware of, if you raise your energy, if you meet them with a higher frequency, there are no way they can get to you. And this is why I also feel more safe the higher I feel inside myself, energy-wise, the less vulnerable I think I feel that I am, because I've exposed some of modern times' worst serial killers. I've exposed assassins. So very scary areas. I've been very afraid at times, but at the same time, I'm still here, and I believe one of the reasons is that my approach is from love, not trying to get into their ball game.
So you've really helped us out. You've explained what you mean by transcending, and you were putting it in terms of raising your own frequency, but it's through your belief system. It's through an action. It's through an immersion in a way of being and a way of feeling, and not necessarily through pure exercise. And that's, you know, something I haven't heard anyone put it this way. And yes, it is NLP. It is neuro-linguistic programming when you use a word to change your state like that. But you have, luckily, in your biology, the roots of this transformation, because you've practiced it, you've witnessed it, and you've, oddly enough, chosen to put yourself in these situations where you would have to use it. Now, can I just ask you, did you actually ride a bicycle from Sweden to South Africa? Did you actually do that, or you flew with a bicycle?
No, I rode an old bicycle from Sweden down to the border to Turkey, and then I somehow got into Iran. I wasn't supposed to go. It was in the middle of the war between Iran and Iraq. So I've written a book called Shadow of Tears about the whole thing, what happened down there, how I thought that this was a country I was very afraid of. It was the year 1984. I thought it was a country filled with crazy people, fanatics running around screaming Allah Akbar, shooting each other. But something deep inside me just say, go there, even though they closed the borders at that time, more or less for everyone abroad. But something inside of me was just saying, go. And in the end, I managed to get a visa. I entered there, and I'm in there. Instead of meeting these awful people, I met some of the most magnificent human beings I've ever met in such a difficult situation. And they, after a while, they saw me as a sincere person who really started to care for them. So they took me around everywhere in Tehran and everywhere, showing me what was actually going on in this country, because it was a country in extreme difficulties, you know, with extreme oppression and, secret police everywhere, revolutionary guards, people being pulled off the buses, shot in the streets, you know, executed in the prisons, awful, and bombings going on all the time, awful, awful. But at the same time, in this situation, I saw these people, these few families that I got to know very well, how generous they were, how kind and warm they were to each other, even though they were under such pressure. Then one of them, unfortunately, got murdered very tragically, and his brother thought that he was going to be the next one in line and was very scared, and he had been preparing together with his friend to escape from the country for years but haven't succeeded. So I just did everything I could. I sold stuff off in Sweden that managed to get false papers and tickets and so on for us, and then we left and managed to get out through former Russia, East Germany, and up to Sweden, where he's now a heart specialist. And we also managed to get out to seven other people. So my book, Shadow of Tears, is about this whole true story. Lots of pictures, lots of all of these things. But one of the things that I saw in this situation down there was how people, normal people, in a difficult situation, in a very strong situation where you need to make a choice who you are, some people that were weak inside chose to become the oppressors. These were the people who got a boost of pulling people off the bus to make roadblocks and scare the crap out of people to torture them. Some of these people chose that one. Other people chose to be just normal people trying to cope with it. And other people chose to become like guerrilla fighters and so on and so on. So it's like, it was a very, very powerful experience to see, my God, these are people just like in my home country, where the situation has just forced them to divert, to split into different groups. So I really felt, my God, in a situation like that, who would I be? What would I choose? You know, would I be able to stand up for what is right, what I know is right, or would I be weak as well and become one of the so-called bad guys? And what is a bad guy, you know, for the regime, these people that were torturing people, they were heroes, and for the people, they were monsters. It's like so confusing.
Well, but, let me ask you this. You're saying that you saw these situations, or you and these other people were in a situation that forced the splitting into three different camps. But also, you all said that we choose which camp we're going into. So is that a conscious choice, or is that just a reversion that one makes based on one's exercise of one's lowest or highest frequency? Because you just told us you rode a bike. I can't even think of a single person in the world that I've ever met that would do that. Ride a bicycle from Sweden? Just look at the map. And end up in Iraq, but you were on the way to South Africa? It's crazy. But it's also extremely unusual. I mean, you changed your world, your life situation, and you were compelled to. It sounds like there was nothing else you could do. And that this is how you learned. You pulled out of yourself this whole new understanding of natural metaphysics, natural law, how we are put together on a very, very deep level, and how we can bring that into a new kind of experience, a way to experience the world. This is what I'm getting from you, and I'm barely able to understand it, but it's very unusual, very, very unusual.
You know, most people say I should have looked up a psychiatrist instead. Yeah, I don't know. No, but it's just that when I look at my life, when I try to apply for a job many times, very few times have I been able to get a job because my CV is very diverse in many different areas. And they say, but how can you do this, you do that, you know, and you must be a very confused person. I don't see that at all. I see that, you know, for me, it's writing or making music or making paintings or something like it's, they go very much hand in hand. For me, it's like harmony, colors, there are colors in music, there's colors in the way you write with feelings. And they go totally hand in hand for me. And this thing with a bicycle, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I was just following my nose, you know. I just felt I need to get out in the world. I need to stop as a journalist because I was working at a newspaper. I've written about everything that could have happened in that town. You know, the only thing that I hadn't written about was like maybe a major airplane crash or something like that, and that was something I didn't want to write about anyway. It was just getting into a loop, and I just felt I need to break out, you know, because I felt that I grew up in a country where it was almost like I had like concrete walls inside. My feelings were so hidden behind concrete inside of me with a nice facade, smiling facade, but I could not get in touch with the real me. And apparently I needed something very powerful like Iraq conflict, you know. It's like swallowing a couple of dynamite sticks and blowing myself up from the inside emotionally. And so I had, you know, I have no idea why I did these things or how. I just did it without, one step at a time, and it just led me into these situations. But I strongly feel that our lives are a series of this. It's based on a constant series of decisions, a yes, a no. And you always have the option in whatever situation you are, love, hate, yes, no, whatever it is. And these things will step by step by step by step lead you onto whatever the path of your life is. This has turned out to be my path. I had no idea I would end up like this.
It takes a willingness to go out of your comfort zone. And when you decided to go on the bicycle spree to the other side of the world, you were really removing yourself entirely from your job, the comfort zone, the small town, the very staid writing and reporting that you were doing. And so that's, again, something that is very unusual. Most people would not completely crack their world open and throw themselves into another one altogether. And the level of fear, I mean, the unknown that you faced just cycling off like that, most people would deem to be absolutely complete nuts, you know. But it is also extremely courageous, extremely brave. It shows a willingness to experience anything with no preparation whatsoever, and to call from you the deepest, most creative abilities you have, and a kind of faith, and, you know, just living really in the moment. That is a very, very good example of wanting to do that. And again, I don't know anyone who would have done something like that at all.
Actually, neither do I.
You are so you. And you know, it is true. I have a favorite expression, and I'm looking at it right now. It's scotch taped over my desk, and the ink is so faded I can barely read it, but I know what it is. A straight line is the quickest way to the wrong place. So when you make those decisions, yes, no, right, wrong, love, terror, what you're really doing is carving out that zigzag, right?
Mm. If you look in nature, there's more or less never a straight line. It always goes in zigzags.
That's right. It's always curved. It's never straight. No bones in your body are straight. They are actually twisted struts. And all geometry comes from the helix, which is a twisted strut. Twist.
And if you look at a lightning or something like that, it goes in a straight line, but suddenly it turns off, and it breaks out and branches out into different areas. And it's so powerful, and it's still not a straight line. I don't think straight lines. I really think that when I see on my life, when I've had like where I think, oh my God, this is going to be a total success or whatever, very quickly, every single time it has not. Instead, it's the slowly, 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 slowly. That is the one that builds up the stamina, and that is the one that gives results in the long run.
Yeah.
I think this is also where you have these so-called overnight sensations, you know, very young musicians and rock stars and so on. They get success, boom, so quickly, and then boom, they go down because they can't handle it. They can't handle the situation, so they turn to drugs and whatever, and they burn themselves out very quickly.
Right. Well, they're also a phenomenon that is made. Nobody reaches stardom without the assistance of the people behind the programs of today. That's what I've learned. So you went into assassinations, and did that come out of your desire to meet terror on its deepest level?
I have no idea, Sophia. What happened was that I think that... When I grew up, I grew up in a family that was very much involved during the Second World War with the resistance movement, the guerrilla movement against the Nazi occupation. And so I grew up with all of these stories and how important it is to stand up even though you're David against Goliath, and to do the right thing even though it might seem very scary. And I have... I really don't know what took me on this path. I just know that in my heart, from a very early stage, I felt that I'm here to make a difference. I'm gonna make a difference for the better. Whatever it takes, I'm gonna do it. And I try to do that in all situations.
Now, you were born in Denmark, but you grew up in Sweden, and your father was in the military.
He was in the military in Denmark and also in the resistance movement in Denmark. My granddad was in jail for helping smuggling Jews to Sweden. My grandmother's sister used to smuggle weapons for the guerrilla movement in baby cots and so on. So I grew up with this very close to my heart, and so did my brother and sister, who are also very involved in this awakening movement when it comes to what's going on in the world today.
So then you, but I know that you transferred, your family transferred to Sweden, and that's where you grew up, that you spent more time, right? So you have plumbed the world of assassinations, and recently I sent you a couple of books by Dave McGowan, who I've also interviewed, and you will find him on my podcast, and you wrote me a little note and said that these books had raised you or taken you to another level. Do you want to try to explain that?
The level that I must say, Darren McGowan, I really, really respect his research and these books. If I can recall, one is called Laurel Canyon. I'm sorry, I can't remember them. Programmed to Kill is one,
right,
and Weird Scenes in the Canyon.
Yeah, Programmed to Kill is his book about assassins, and that's what I sent that to you because that's your specialty, as I understood it to be right now. And then the Laurel Canyon book is all about the music industry and how that is pretty much manufactured. It's another extension of our you know, false culture or our engineered culture.
Yeah, But I strongly feel after 30 years plus of looking into major assassinations like the JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, Olof Palme, Salvador Allende, I mean so many of these big Malcolm X assassinations and false flag operations as well, that in the early 1960s there was a major takeover, a major coup d'etat, when the cabal, or whatever you want to call them, took a major step forward in the form of killing JFK. And I would say that I would humbly suggest that all the long line of presidents that have been in power, so-called power, since that assassination, have been just another phase of the same very, very brutal war machine that took over that day. And so not only is it the same small group that has given the orders to carry these assassinations out to get rid of people that were standing in their way, but they have also, to a great extent, used the same team of assassins over the years, especially one group that I identified as, it's called Operation 40, a group that was a big part of the JFK assassination. They were part of the Robert Kennedy, they were part of killing Salvador Allende, Che Guevara, blowing up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., and many, many assassinations worldwide. But with his books, one of the things was that I started seeing a very clear pattern that at the same time as this cabal took over in late 1963 and 64, so many agendas were activated, I would say, that had been in the planning. And as soon as they took over, boom, they started moving forward. They moved forward very strongly with MKUltra, with the Vietnam War, with other wars. They were starting taking out elected presidents and leaders of many other countries. The CIA was just spreading all over, forcing their terror on the world and so on. And through David McGowan's books, I also saw that not only were they using the strategy of tension to create or use a lot of so-called false flag operations and terror acts to scare the crap out of normal people so that they would welcome more and more militarized police, surveillance, all of these things. But not only were they using terror acts, they were also using serial killers, which I had no idea about. Because I thought that serial killers, even though I've always been interested in, and I always found it very odd that they're more or less, all of them are located in the States, which I thought that is very strange, because it should be just equally spread all over the globe, but it's not. It's like, I would say 95% is in the States.
Yeah, a long time ago, I asked myself the same question, you know, about serial killings, and I figured out it was not a human phenomenon. It was something that was contrived in certain people who were vulnerable and could be trained that way. And Kay Griggs, she is the, I don't know if you've heard of her, but...
Yes, of course.
Yes, she goes into that, the training of assassins and the specialization that they give to certain people who are called rising stars. They're not political rising stars like Obama has been called by the press. And when this term is thrown around, by the way, in the press, it's not a lightly used term. It's not that somebody just gets it out of their head. It's because this person they're referring to has been selected and is being groomed for something. And so the assassins who come out of these programs, these training programs, they too are referred to as rising stars. And in their own ranks, they are selected by special profiling and then specifically trained and, of course, shut down in terms of their own humanness so that they can do these things, right?
Yeah. And just like you say, trained assassins, I would say many thanks to David McGowan's books and so on, it's opened up a way of seeing that many of these serial killers have been trained just like assassins, but in a different area. And quite a few of them have had to become a patsy and take the fall for lots of homicides and killings that were not the deed of one person. Often it was teams that went in there and executed people, straightforward executions. And then it was camouflaged with some hideous crimes where people were just chopped up in pieces and so on in ritualistic ways, blamed on the same killer, where it was not. It was. I would say that the patterns are very strong when you look into it, that if I reverse a little bit, if you look at the CIA's handbook on assassination, how they train their agents to commit and perform assassination, they normally instruct them to either use something they can find at the scene, you know, so that they don't approach the crime scene with a weapon and they don't leave with a weapon. They find whatever, a screwdriver, a hammer, a lamp, whatever, to knock the head in of the victim. Or if they approach the crime scene with a weapon, then a 22 caliber is the best weapon, because if you got a more powerful handgun, the chance of you, even though you do a headshot, the chances of the bullet just passing right through the skull of the victim, leaving the victim alive, is quite big, contrary to what most people think. But if you use a 22 caliber, what happens is that it's got enough power to enter the skull but not to exit, so the bullet inside the head will start ricocheting inside and cause maximum damage to the brain and more or less always be lethal. When you look at these so-called serial killers and what we're being, I would say, brainwashed through Hollywood and so on, you've got this profiling that a serial killer is always looking for a certain type of victim, like a redhead 22-year-old woman, all of them with the same kind of haircut, or only white women, or only black or children, or whatever it is. When you look at these famous ones, it doesn't make any sense at all. Their victim ranges from everything from children to old pensioners and so on. And with all types of the type of killing, strangulation, headshots, knives, whatever, does not make sense, the official version we have been fed. But when you look at it, many, many times the victims have been killed with headshots while they've been asleep or whatever, with a 22. That is reoccurring all the time, just like the CIA instructs. Headshot, point blank, boom, 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 often when people are asleep, and then the crime scene is totally cleaned up afterwards, and so on. So I would very strongly suggest that it would be a very good idea to look into these major serial killers. I would also like to point out that the Bush family is incredibly central in so much mayhem that has occurred in this world over the last 100 years, with Prescott Bush, his father, George, and Boy George, and so on. My God, it's incredible. And one of the things is that George Bush Sr., he has personally pardoned several of these very, very highly skilled assassins, like Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carrillas, who have committed absolute atrocities in many different countries. And then when you look at, for instance, in Texas, which is the center of executions in the world, especially under when Boy George was there, the only person, as far as I know, that was ever pardoned from death row was a man called Henry Lee Lucas. Henry Lee Lucas is, as far as I know, one of the most famous serial killers ever, who on his own account had somewhere between 300 and 600 killings. He was pardoned just a few days before his execution by George Bush Jr. personally, got off the hook. His partner in crime, Otis Toole, self-confessed cannibal and mass murderer, he was pardoned in Florida, Jeb Bush country. And more than one of the other major serial killers, they've been running towards Texas, insisting on being arrested by Texas Rangers. The center of executions, they've been escaping from Mexico, where there's no death penalty, running into to Texas for protection. And if you look at many of these serial killers, most of them has occurred in Texas, in Florida, Chicago, and California. These were, and still are, majorly controlled by the Bush family. So I would say, is that a coincidence, or are we looking at a clear pattern here?
Well, those states are notorious. They have centers of power, either in the families that you're mentioning, or just the Chicago mob, for instance, runs Chicago, you know, and that's, when I speak of mob, I mean, I'm not using that term in the Hollywood way, but I just, you know, wanted to mention that Adam Lanza must have read the CIA handbook, because he used a Bushmaster 22, right? So
it just comes again and again and again and again.
It's their typical, their choice making. This is the way they do it, and I'm not arguing that there was any Adam Lanza or any of this happened, but I'm just saying that what they report fits what they always arrange. So this is their style, you could say. And I remember in the program To Kill book, he brought up, for instance, Son of Sam as an example for our listeners. There are signatures to these murders, and the signatures in the popular press keep confirming to the public that this is the same person performing these murders. But in fact, as you mentioned, Dave shows us how it's actually these trained teams that take people out and create or arrange the typical signature, which is then fictionalized into somebody like David Berkowitz being Son of Sam, and he's always the one that did those particular murders, but in fact he is just Patsy, the cover. Now, are you telling us that the people who are the alleged serial killers, how do they relate to the teams? Do you know?
I don't know. What I know is that quite a few mothers of victims are now working to get some of these convicted serial killers free. And I mean, how would a mother of a murdered child do a thing like that without being very, very convinced that it's the wrong man behind the bars? When you look at, what is very obvious, what a very clear pattern is that the real serial killers have protection from a top, from the top. They get away with murder. They're let loose right away. They're arrested and then let free, the police look the other way, or the same people, same police officers, pops up in many different cases. Many of them with connections to the FBI or working for the FBI. The FBI comes in and clears the scene and let the guy go. Even though sometimes the killer says, please don't let me loose, I'm dangerous, I have this voice in my head, I can't control it, they're let off. Then other people, totally innocent, are just hammered. And when you look at somebody like Ted Bundy or so, it does not make sense what he's accused of. I do believe sometimes these serial killers have been involved on some level, but they're taking fault for something much bigger than themselves. That they're just, it's almost like you have to feed the masses with something, you know, like first you create terror, and then when the terror just like this, then we need to give them a solution. So very often a perpetrator is taken and convicted very quickly, very often, you know. They don't have a chance to defend themselves. They have awful lawyers that just say, plead guilty or you end up, or you get fried. So they have no choice. They say, okay, I'm guilty, let me live. But they're not, too many of these things. And so I think many people have been framed. And also when you see how some of them are arrested and the way, just like Ted Bundy, I mean, when you look at the story, he was just driving down through an area with few houses and a police officer just felt, my God, we need to take him because his brake light was not working. So they start chasing him almost, you know, these type of things. It does not make sense.
Right, the old brake light story. Are you familiar with a woman called Anne Rule?
No.
Anne Rule is a commercial fiction, kind of mass market fiction writer. She was a detective in the Seattle Police Department, I believe, and she wrote bestseller after bestseller. She was a true crime writer. And I coached and taught people how to write fiction for many years. And I had to read a lot of it in order to understand the way that you craft and build a story. So even in true crime, you still have to write the story so that it's a page turner. And Anne Rule apparently worked right next to Ted Bundy, and she wrote a book called The Stranger Beside Me about Ted Bundy. So knowing what I know now, having talked to you, it would be very interesting to read that book. And you can pick up Anne Rule books. Ole, I would suggest to you, if you have any spare time at all, buy them. You can probably get them for pennies on Amazon used, and or I'll collect them for you and ship you a crate of them. But this will probably probably show you even another level, and I'd be very interested to see what you get out of it. But so when these serial killers are pardoned by the Bushes, for instance, are they pardoning the Patsy? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
No. Not the Patsies. The mechanic. They are pardoning the real killer.
Oh.
No. But when this guy is too good to let go of, I mean, so they let them loose again. Or they're pardoned for maybe, I don't know what the reasons are. Maybe this person has some kind of a hold on them, some kind of blackmail thing, and they let them go of that. I don't know. But I do know, I just want to mention one thing in David's book, is that he claims that Henry Lee Lucas on many occasions has said that he was the one that went down to Jonestown, Do you know where this so-called mass suicide took place, Jim Jones?
Yes.
That he was the one that was put on a plane by people from, I think, the FBI or whatever, with the poison and flew down there. So
yes.
Now we're talking not a serial killer, but somebody very deeply involved with the CIA on a very high level, but who's being presented as a totally mad mass murderer. Do you know several of these so-called mass murderers, they were trained in Operation Phoenix. Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, where they were almost given medal for becoming cannibals and chopping off heads of people and just doing awful things. Then they were sent back in normal society where this was not okay, and then suddenly they were monsters, but they used them there to sort out problems, to get rid of people.
Now, I heard you say on another interview that some of the very high-level assassins cut their teeth in Dealey Plaza. They were there, and that was a long time ago, and some of these people are still alive. So can you confirm that? I mean, that was, the early 1960s. So here we are in 2014. How young must they have been then, and are they still doing their stuff now?
Many of them have died. Many of them have died a very violent death. You know, it's like the old West, the gunslingers. You live by the gun, you die by the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them they've been in very violent circumstances when it comes to drugs, weapon smuggling, and assassinations, terror acts. So many of them have died, but some of them are still active. I know... One of these serial killers that I exposed, or two of them together with Professor Jim Fetzer, his name is Clyde Forshaw, and his cousin, Walter Tobinski, both of them living in Toronto. These were part of the Kennedy assassination. They were in Dealey Plaza, both of them firing weapons. And also Walter Tobinski, he's the man that was photographed coming out of the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, pretending to be Oswald. You will see his photos in many different books. Also in the JFK movie, you can see him. And these people are still alive. And Clyde Forshaw, as far as I know, he's, to this very day, he's a bank robber together with different family members. And he's committed, he and Walter Tobinski, according to a very reliable witness, have each committed about 1,000 assassinations each, or killings, murders, of everything from children to women to you name it. So they have been used since the late 50s and all the way up until today to take care of everything from witnesses to contract killings to whatever. And awful.
Would you say these people have been ritually programmed in order to do this? I mean, you're telling me they're living in Toronto as, I suppose, free men, right?
Yeah.
And so they have altars. They must have another self that comes, it's, that awakens in order to... I'm trying to make sense of it, so do you know?
As far as I know, Walt Sabinski was born about 1940 and Clyde Forshaw 1943, as far as I know. And if the info I've been given is correct, they were trained by some kind of SS officer, I believe from that, maybe through Operation Paperclip that was imported to the States, at a very, very early age to become these so-called monsters. They train them, as far as I've been informed. They start with animals, torturing, killing animals, and then they move up. They start killing children, and then the older they get, when they get up in the teenagers, they are used first as killing women, and then later on men as well. And so they're trained from a very young age to do these atrocities.
Right. I think we have to take a break, and you have to teach us some Raja Yoga right now.
For the...
To get us through this. No, it was a little joke. But no, that's very heavy. You know, it's very sad also to think that people are put through these stages of they're being acclimated. You know, they're being broken down. They're being split off from what they would naturally do because.
But this is also why I try not to put any judgment on them. You know, if who knows if I had been. As a small child had been abused in that way. I mean, many of these people have gone through absolute awful stuff as children, you know, in with MKUltra experiments and all types of awful, awful things to become this very brutal tool. So who knows? I'm lucky I was the one who could take a bicycle and make my own choice. These people were maybe forced into this situation. So I'm not here to pass judgment. I just wanted to stop, you know, stop it. It's been going on for far too long, this madness.
So I know that having spoken to Kay Griggs personally many, many times on the phone, and then I believe I interviewed her once many years ago when I was on RBN, but she says that this is handed down over the generations, that all the people who are training and breaking these new victims down receive the same fracturing of self themselves. So this is an age-old ritualistic separation of society, that certain people become very rabidly destructive by having been inducted into this by their elders, you could say. And that this, I almost feel like this doesn't have a top, an independent top of the pyramid that has spared itself from this or that doesn't go through this, you know, that we are really seeing something that is almost like a centuries-long habit.
I think this has been going on for thousands of years. I don't know. It's just been more and more sophisticated. In the way they break down people also. But this is just like you're describing now, we're talking victims, making new victims, creating new victims that create new victims. We need to break the cycle. So for me, like I say, I have no solution, no clear solution. My vision is clear, but my solution, I don't know. I just know that it's, for instance, I'm a personal friend of Chip Tatum. He's a former 25-year deep cover CIA agent. He was a black op assassin. He was not one of the Night Stalker pilots. He was one of the pilots in the Iran-Contras. And he was also he was the commander of an ultra-secret hit team called Pegasus under the direct control of George Bush Sr. And they have carried out at least 17 assassinations globally under his command.
So where is he today? Is he free today?
Yeah, he's in Florida. He's in Florida. He turned a whistleblower, and he stood up against George Bush and these other people, which is absolutely incredible in my book. But for me to have a relationship with him, because I really, really like and respect Chip, at the same time, it's very confusing because here is a man that I know have murdered people, that I know have tortured people, that I know have done absolute atrocities. And at the same time, so there's no way I can, I don't know what you say, commend or accept these actions. At the same time, since the late 1990s, he has stood up and tried to redeem him in every possible way by fearlessly exposing what he has been part of and the powers that he has been working for. So it's a very confusing relationship And it's just like when I see the future and what's going on in the world, it's very, very confusing.
Right. So would you say he has broken his own programming? He's no longer programmed, or are there parts of him that are still programmed?
I don't think he was programmed. As far as he speaks himself, I never heard him talk about programming. I know that he was hijacked in as a, he was like so many other people. He was recruited when he was 19, and he just ended up. He was part of one of the first false flag operations that, not one of the first, he thinks it's one of the first, but it's absolutely not, but in a false flag operation I think it was Thailand, just in the beginning of the Vietnam War. And he was supposed to die. It was a suicide mission, but he was not aware of it. And when he managed to survive, the CIA, instead of killing him, because he was almost dead, he was shot several times and so on, and taken back to hospital. But when he woke up, they gave him the option, either you work with us or we will more or less kill you. That's not the exact details, but more or less like that. And they said, the only way we can control you, because you know too much, is that you work for us. And so he was taken in at a very young age, and they got to him, and then he just got himself involved in more and more and more worse and worse stuff. And
as a way to preserve his own life, he did this.
This is the thing, you know, you get lured into it, and then suddenly you discover you're in such deep shark waters that there's no way out. There's absolutely no way out. It's like he says, the only option I had was to jump from a high building or continue. And he chose to continue.
Until a certain point where you find a way out.
It was only because the former director of the CIA, William Colby, who was the one who recruited him, he took him under his wings, and he said on an early stage, especially when at the time where George Bush came into a more powerful and took over after Colby in the CIA, he said, you need to gather evidence, like a life insurance, as much hard evidence as you can against these people, because they are hard, they play ball very hard, you know. So Chip took, like Bill Colby, who was later murdered, he said, it's too late for me, but please, you do it. You still have the chance. So Chip Tatum started to collect, you know, there were cameras in these Iran-Contras army planes that they flew weapons out from the National Guard. They stole them there, flew them out to Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador, these type of countries, to the Contras army down there. And then they smuggled cocaine, raw cocaine, in back in the tons to airports like MENA and Arkansas, where people like Bill Clinton personally received the drugs together with his partner Dan Lasseter, and sometimes George Bush Sr. as well was there, as well as Jeb Bush and George Bush Jr. They were also at times part of receiving these big shipments of drugs, massive amounts. And Chip was filming them to collect this type of evidence. And then I think it was in the early 1990s or something like that, George Bush Senior was getting very obsessed with Ross Perot, if you remember him, the billionaire who wanted to run for president. And as far as I know, Ross Perot had found out that there were still prisoners left in Vietnam to rot. And he was very upset with that. He went to speak to Vice President Bush, or he wanted to speak to the president to get these people out. And then Bush, as Vice President, stopped him and said, you just back off. This is none of your business. And go away. Where Ross Perot said, listen, I'm a billionaire. I've got the money. I'm going to run for president and sort this thing out. So he wanted to do that. And Bush got very upset and gave the order to Chip Tatum to eliminate Ross Perot. And that was the thing that it was just too much for Chip, and he just exploded and said, absolutely no way have I ever agreed upon assassinating or eliminating people on American people on American soil. And so George Bush, they wanted to kill him, but then he showed them the evidence he had, and that made them back off. And in the end, he managed to, play bargain with them. So he agreed upon taking a prison sentence to discredit his own name. So he sat in prison for a couple of years. And then after that, he has become a whistleblower and are exposing a major part of what he's been involved in.
So I'd like to ask you a question. When you described Chip Tatum just a few minutes ago as someone who was involved in multiple assassinations, these were all not in America. They were not American people and not on American soil.
I've asked him to name some of these victims. He named two of them, and these people have been... one were Israeli, and the other one was from one of these Latin American countries. The other ones he has not named.
Okay, but you just said that he refused to take out Ross Perot. He said, no yeah. way, no... I'm not doing American people on American soil. So that yeah. would lead me to believe that the ones he agreed to act on were not American and not on American soil. And you've just named two. So I'm just trying to make a distinction here in my own mind.
That is what makes perfect sense. But I don't know, because Chip has not wanted to go into these details. I would very much recommend you. I can put you in touch with him, and he can come on your program. You can ask him these questions yourself, because he's got an incredible background and an incredible wealth of information in many, many areas that are normally totally unknown.
Well, okay. I guess I could try that, but...
Totally up to you, Sophia.
I have one question. Now, again, I am not trying to... This is simply a technical question. Just take it that way, okay? But I'm trying to learn more. And you seem to have a very big grasp on this, and you're grasping it from the soul of your being, I'll say that. And you're not coming with judgment and so forth. And you may find this to be too scientific a term for you, but we've thrown this term around a lot in our alternative world of conspiracy research. So would you say that Chip Tatum... was a sociopath?
I don't understand that word enough to answer yes or no.
Okay, because we use this term. There's psychopath, there's sociopath, and they're both kind of related, and one is a lot worse than another. A sociopath is just a person who is an inveterate liar, for instance, and doesn't seem to care about other people and acts as he wishes in society, regardless of the consequences. So that he can benefit himself.
That is not Chip, not at all.
A psychopath is someone who's a shade, and I'm using very loose definitions here that are pretty much, you know, my own, but I'm just going so we can have a little discussion. A psychopath does much darker, much more horrible things, but they're basically from the same root. They just act on different scales, you could say. So a psychopath is someone who wouldn't be afraid to murder people or, you know, act in a way that's very destructive to society and others and extremely violent. So to me, when you say that so-and-so is an assassin, murderer, and he was involved in 17 different whatever events, and finally he said, no, I'm not doing American people on American soil, I'm thinking, well, if he was willing to take people out at all, even though here he is defending, he's trying to preserve his own life. I understand that there's a self-preservation instinct that we all have. But again, I'm not asking you to speak for him. This is just me trying to sort something out in my mind. You're referring to him in praiseful terms, and I think it's great that he's a whistleblower, but you mentioned earlier that you're confused by him, your relationship with him, and I understand that completely. It would be extremely confusing. So I don't know if you can comment any further.
It is, because the confusing part is that I used to think that there were such a thing as a monster or evil people. Maybe they are, but I've never met them. I've just heard about them. And for me to have a close relationship with Chip, he's the closest one that I've got to someone that you could label a monster. And that, but with Chip, I don't feel sociopath or psychopath. I feel that he, do you know, like when you are a soldier and you start off being a totally normal person, I tell you, anyone who gets into a war zone and suddenly are under fire and fires back, or seeing their friends get their guts blown up or their heads blown off or something like that, they start shooting back and they get very, very angry. They get very fearful and they start shooting back and they murder people as well. And being very afraid, they will murder more and more, you know, out of fear and hate and anger and all of these things. Does that make them a monster, or is that what doing what a soldier is supposed to do? It is a very sick experience, the whole thing. But what happens is that they get the first 2, 3, 4 kills they do are very, very hard on them. And then it's sort of like it numbs down. And then in the end, they don't really feel like that. I think it's like if you start as a butcher, for instance, killing cows, the first 2, 3 cows, maybe you will never forget their eyes and so on. And then after a month, it's just another day at the office or the factory. The human being has this ability to numb down, which I think is quite scary. And with Chip, I asked him, since he had been surrounded by killers his whole adult life, and this has always been a mystery to me, I said, when you look at these people, are there any way of, are there different groups? How do they see themselves? Do they see themselves as freedom fighters or soldiers? Do they see that they're doing the right thing, or do they just do it for the money, or are they just killers? And he said to me that as the way he sees it, there are three different categories. There's the one that really believes that they're doing the right thing. But he says that is most of the time very young people that have just started up, and they think that they're doing it for freedom and democracy. He said that wears out very quickly. Very quickly, when you start understanding that this is about business and it's just you are killing machines to pave the road for big company, big greed, this type of thing. So there's these naive ones, first one. Then he said the second group are people that are skilled killers. They know that it's not right what they do, but they do it for the money. They're fine with doing it, and they just kill people. But then he said, then there are what he called dead eyes, the dead eyes. He said, these people are gone. There's no one in there. There's no connection with the soul. It has left, sort of. He said, these people are cold, merciless killers. They are killing machines with no empathy, no compassion, no feeling for the victims. And he said, these are the people that Chip said that sometimes he has nightmares, and this nightmare he's talking about that is reoccurring is that he's lying in his bed on his back, and he wakes up, and one of these dead eyes are hovering right on top of him, and he cannot move. And he said, that is so scary. I mean, my God, I can't even imagine. And this, I know I saw people like that in Iran, some of the soldiers that I know had been involved in awful atrocities. That is exactly what I said. I did not see evil in their eyes. I saw the lack of light. There was nothing. It was dead.
So these people who are so bereft of their humanness, their soul is gone, there's no light anymore, they have been effectively turned into that monster, or are they not yet the monster? Is that what you're saying?
The dead eyes are pure monsters, I would say. And I asked Chip, is there any, can you rescue somebody like that? Can you save him? And he said, as far as he see it, they're too damaged, they're goners, it's beyond, you cannot get them back. But he said that these people have been going through so many awful things, and that is what has killed the soul. It has left, it's not there anymore.
So he would come in the second group then, the person who did it for the money.
I would say that just my interpretation of Chip is that he's the same person with a good heart, capable of awful things, or have been in the past, as a soldier is supposed to do, but also I think he's unique since he's one of the few whistleblowers on that level that have had the guts to come forward. He's one of the very, very few. So I think he's quite a unique individual, and that makes it not very easy to categorize him. So I really value him. And at the same time, like I say, I can accept what he's done before. Mm-hmm. It's confusing. He says to me, he knows that he will have to pay for what he's done. He said, I know I've done things that are awful. I take full responsibility for it. One day my time will come. You know, he's under a lot of threat. They tried to take him out many times. He knows that he can be dead any day. And he said, he has accepted that. He's done. There are many things in his life he's done, and there are a few of them that he would regret. So you make up your mind. I don't know.
How old is he now?
He's 64, as far as I know.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting, you know, and I'm not trying to ask you these questions in the attempt to slot him, but when he talks about the three groups, I'm wondering, well, which one was he part of? And I'll tell you, Ole, I had a friend who had two sons. One had joined the Air Force and was very, very, let's just call it successful. He loved being in the Air Force. He was fitting in really well. And so the younger brother decided he would also join the Air Force. And boy, oh boy, was he not cut out for that. He was discharged within a month. Apparently, he started crying as soon as he got there because it was so horrible, the training that they were being put through. He pretty much, he figured out that he was either going to go mad or he was going to act mad. And he acted mad. Insane, and they put him in a room, and psychiatrists traipsed in to interrogate him, and finally they just told him, look, you know, we're going to give you a discharge because you're just not suited to be in the Air Force, and because he was terrified and crying and maybe even putting on a little bit of that to make it more dramatic. But when he got out, I had a conversation with him, and first he was terrified. He told me that they had given him more than 20 vaccinations in 1 month's time, and had never been vaccinated in his whole life. And he kept saying, what do you think they did to me? What do you think they did with these vaccinations? I said, I don't know, but it's good you were never vaccinated, and you're just going to have to see what the effects of these vaccines are going to be on you, but you're very lucky to be out. And then he told me that when they sat down to eat, when they were in this boot camp, which is Air Force is apparently a cut above military, army. But nonetheless, they would sit down to eat, these young kids, in their first month. And he said lieutenants and people of higher rank would stand right behind them. And they would have to shovel their food down their throats in like 3 minutes. And these higher rank sergeants and officers would be screaming curse words and all kinds of four-letter words at them from behind, you know, just barking these ugly words. And then they would have to chant in between bites themselves, the boys, we dine in hell, we dine in hell, we dine in hell. There you go. So, you know, that's how I guess they start altering your personality with these rituals, and you get used to it. And that's the lowest level. That's the first couple of weeks.
Oh, we had to stop this madness. That's all I say. It has to stop on so many levels.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say we have to stop this interview.
No, not at all. But yeah. It's just, But what really I think is so mind-blowing and strange and sick, I would say, is that these young people who, they join the army, they think that now I'm going to go out and liberate the world and fight for freedom and democracy, and I'm going to come home with medals and people are going to treat me with respect and so on. And then what happens instead, that they turn into killing machines and giving medals for doing absolute awful, awful stuff. And then either they come home, and I always get confused when I see like stand-up comedians or whatever show there is, and suddenly they see somebody in a uniform in the audience and they say, oh, look at you, we really appreciate what you're doing for us out there. Not understanding what the army is actually doing out there. My God, it's awful, it's awful. And then everybody applauds them. Or they come home after having done their duty and being blown up in pieces and being treated like absolute dirt, not even being given housing or anything, ending up in the streets, being done all kinds of awful medical experiments on. And it's like, it is so out of balance. And do you know, like Chip Tatum, who's been in his army his whole world, he says that the biggest terrorist tool in the world is the American army. Mm-hmm. And I would say with a military bases in more than 150 countries, my God, when you compare that, and also how many wars have so-called terrorist countries like Sudan or Libya or Iran, how many have they started over the years? One, not even, maybe one, maximum two. You look at the States, we're up in the hundreds. And once again, it's after the coup d'etat when they took out JFK. That is where it really accelerated. So we're back to the same cabal that is just causing mayhem all over the place.
Well, I remember reading an article about soldiers in the earlier wars, like Korea and before that, even World War II. American soldiers apparently did not want to finish off the damage. They would wound someone and then they would leave him. And this was not approved of by the top brass. The top brass wanted them to... They weren't killers. They were too sympathetic. They wanted to turn them into people who would actually finish the job. And so the training changed in the military after this was studied and decided. And they were trained now to be, they are trained now to be very much more brutal and unfeeling. So that's part of, you could say, the MO or the mission statement of troops, even though on the surface it certainly isn't, but it's definitely given to them in their indoctrination.
Yep.
Very sad.
Very, very sad. This is why very often in interviews I speak directly to people in uniform. I speak directly to police or SWAT teams or whatever. I speak directly to members of the elite as well, to try and reach their heart, to remind them of who they are and what they've turned into. You know, it's very, very sad, especially with soldiers, I think.
Well, Ole, I'm going to ask you this question, and again, it's not really a surprise question, but I just thought of it. How much of this behavior and training, and then the adherence to the training and behavior, you know, you'll do the same old, rather than depart from that. How much of it do you think is rooted in or related to being male, the concept of being male?
Could you say, I did not really understand that question. You please say it again?
I'm going to refer not to the assassins necessarily, because they're a much higher degree of destruction, destructive thinking, destructive behavior, okay? But we were talking about the soldiers and being trained to be a good soldier. And even though you're talking about appealing to people through their heart, and I'm saying, well, you know, if you try that, maybe it won't work because these people who've been trained in this way, killing machines, even in the context of being a soldier, even if they still believe they're doing it for the good of their country, to defend freedom and democracy, they may not involve or invoke themselves from the level of the heart because they are doing this because this is male. They entered the military. They are a male. They're going to do this. This is how they've been trained. So there's that whole concept of, no, I can't be a softy. I can't come from my heart.
This is done by design, I would say, over generations, how to make males into unfeeling, the total opposite of wimps. You know, it's the whole John Wayne era. I think it came more and more from there on, and it's just getting worse and worse.
Right.
This is why they. I'm not avoiding the question. It's just that I don't really have an answer for it. I think that the male is the one that in your heart you have this whole warrior spirit that you have to stand up and defend your family. That is not really the woman's part when it comes to the original family structure. It is up to the man to defend his children. He's the one with the muscles and so on. And we've got it in our genes that we have to stand up. But they've used that and turned it around for their gain, I mean for their greed. And this is why they want kids as young as possible so that they can get to them while they're still not totally mature and while their brains and mentality are still soft enough so they can get to them. So that makes it even more tragic, I would say. But now there are so many female soldiers as well, so they're sort of pushing it aboard the sex barriers so that the females are becoming more and more brutal as well, more and more dehumanized in this area as well.
Right, and now we're getting into the blurring of the genders and the whole synthetic humanity that they're building, and they're actually doing it on a biological level as well. So it'll be easier to do that, and people are more and more removed from their emotions anyway. They are more in the second dimensional world of their phone and their Facebook. And they're also recruiting people who are disadvantaged. They promise you a college degree at the end of it, college education, the military will pay for this, pay for that, this is your opportunity. I mean, some kids sign up because you get a pair of boxer shorts.
What can I say? It's very tragic. But this is the way it's been done, and this is the way they do it. And I say, study history, go back, see how they've manipulated the masses, how over hundreds and hundreds of years, how an elite few they have elected themselves as being the elite few, and then how to control the masses, and they just refine the methods that the old Romans and Greeks used to manipulate and control with, and it's just getting through technique. It's just being multiplied in so many different areas of life.
Okay, well, I figured out a good way to end our show, or we'll go on and on and on.
So let me hear.
Okay, so I was going to suggest that because you've said emphatically multiple times in this interview that you just want this to stop, and it needs to stop, that you and I and the listeners who have reached this stage of the interview will just do that for a moment with the enormity of ourselves and souls, just hold this for a moment of, as they call it, silence. This must stop. We're saying no, and no is a very powerful word.
I've got a very beautiful prayer that I could fill in at the same time, if that would be okay.
Okay, so let's do the moment, and then let's do that. Okay. Thank you.
The prayer goes like this. It's Melanie that uses this one. I absolutely love it. I'm not a religious person, but I feel I'm a spiritual being, and this goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who hurt us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light. We all need to heal, otherwise this will continue. So we need to take care of each other and help heal each other. And it's not to make this stop, that is just the first step, because then the whole question comes to, what are we going to do with this world once this little group of hoodlums stop terrorizing the neighborhood? Are we capable of creating a beautiful new future for ourselves? We who cannot even agree upon what type of pizza to order or where to go, you know, or in a family, we can't even be at peace in our own families. Can we lift this world the way it's supposed to be? That is the next major step. But first of all, we need to transcend the situation now. The house is on fire. We need to focus and get this sorted and then take it to the next level.
You know, I was just thinking when you were saying that, how are we going to do it because we can't even agree on what pizza to order, that what you brought up very early in the show, the zigzag line that is created, your true path when you say yes or no, right or wrong, love or terror, that if everybody answered all of their choices coming from that in the truest way they could, maybe there would be more harmony, you know, in the way people were making decisions, rather than answering, making these choices just from pure willfulness or whim.
Do you know, when you speak to Native Indians, especially the way they used to speak, you said something and then there was silence for a while. And then they answered, because they took the time to think and then say, instead of us just reacting. As soon as somebody mentions it, we react, the word comes back, boom, 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 boom. There's no time to really feel what is it I'm saying. Am I just saying things to say it, or do I really have an opinion? Can I really bring something into this situation so that it can come into fruition in some way or other? But there's one way I find that is good for me, and that is if I sort of cut my day into sequences. Because if I take it in smaller sequences, then it's easier for me to see what my intention is just for that. For instance, now I'm doing this interview with you. That is one sequence. My intention is I will do everything I can to spread out a feeling of unity, compassion, love, all of that. Boom. Once that's done, once I say bye-bye, Sophia, that is the end of that sequence. Then my sequence is I will go out to my family, spend some time with them. My intention there, what is my intention? To be loving with them. Okay, then maybe after that I need to take the car down to the garage. At that time my intention is to drive carefully so that I will not hurt anyone or myself on the way. You know, when the phone rings, that's a new sequence. What is my intention with that phone call? And so on. If you cut it up into smaller pieces, it's easier to put your intention in each and every part of it. And then the better you get at it, the bigger parts or sequences you can make, so that the intention becomes more general. Because otherwise people think, oh my God, I can't, my intention for my whole life, I'm so confused at the moment, my brain, my thoughts are just going all over the place, I can't focus on anything. So this is just one thing that helps me to chop it up in smaller pieces.
That's actually wonderful. I was going to ask you at the beginning of the show to describe a typical day in your life. And then I thought, no, I better not ask that because that's too intrusive. And I, you know, he has his own privacy. We don't want to get that deep into who Oli
is. Listen, Sophia, Sophia, really, I have no privacy. I really have. I whatever you ask me for, I will answer. If it only has to do with me, so feel free. Don't stop yourself.
You already created my question by giving the answer that I was going to, you know, try to find earlier in the show, and that's a beautiful way to do it, to take your day, break it up into these little segments. And so you've really taught me a lot, and it's about, I think what you're doing is living very consciously, task by task, you know?
Do you know, it's like when you call somebody, before you make the call, make up what is it you want to accomplish, you know? And when the phone rings, be very aware, what is it I want to... Sometimes if the phone rings and you pick it up, first hear who it is, then you can say, yeah, hang on, please just wait a second. Then make up your, what is I want to do with this? What do I want to do with this call? What is it I'm aiming for? And then go back, but be centered once you do it, instead of getting into like a conversation confused and get out of it confused, getting a result, a confused result and so on. It makes it easier, I find it, to take one little chapter at a time. And then these chapters start building up so that you see that the general direction of your road takes you away from anger, from despair, from these things. Because also one of the major keys is they try to control us through fear, low energy. How do you raise your energy? Because the more you raise it, the less they can control you. And that goes for everyone else around you. Fill your heart with gratitude. That is the key. The strong, not think gratitude, feel it. You have to feel it in your heart. Feel it. Whatever situation you are in, if you focus, if you look around you, you will find yourself things you can be grateful for. If you only got one leg, if you're missing a leg, you got one leg. If you're missing one eye, you got another eye. If you're blind, you can hear. You got food, maybe you haven't got food, then you have a bed. If you haven't got a bed, maybe you have a brother, a sister, a mother. You know, there's always something that you can be grateful for if you look for that one. And if you feel it, the more you feel it in your heart, the energy of you will raise, it will go up. So the more you look around and appreciate and be grateful for what life is giving you, the higher the energy goes, and you will see that, oh my God, I'm starting to feel better, and turn off the TV, turn off that programming box. It's even called TV programs. It's not by coincidence. Turn it off if you don't want to be controlled. And then focus on people around you. Focus on your family. See, oh my God, I've got a wife, I've got children. I haven't spoken to them for a while. Maybe we can do something fun. You know, go out, do good things, spread good things, do random acts of kindness instead of drive-by shootings, do drive-by huggings, you know, go out, appreciate police officers that are doing a good job, that are honest, go up, tell them, my God, I really admire you for you, what you're doing, protecting us, instead of just focusing on the bad eggs that are messing everything up and corruption and all of these. Let's appreciate the ones that are really making a difference. And I tell you, I think sometimes it's so easy, you know, so easy. So many people are in despair at the moment, are so lost and under such pressure financially and so on. So one of the things that you can give them, one of the strongest gifts you can give them, is the gift of hope. Just that somebody sees them, you know, when they're in a dark hour, that somebody sees them. So one thing, you know, you drive down the highway, there's a toll road or something like that. Pay for the car that comes behind you. Anonymous acts, you know, they have no idea who you are. You just say, here's another dollar or something like that, please, for the car who comes. The one that comes up behind you might be in a very dark spot, you know. And then when he comes there and they say, no, the car in front of you paid for you, I tell you, it can make incredible difference. Or pay for the coffee for somebody you see in the coffee shop. Don't do it so that they see that it's you. Don't expect a thank you. That is a big trap, because then it's you do it from your ego. But if you do it without expecting anything in the back in return, that is where magic happens. So many different areas. When your neighbor is not home, go clean their garden. You know, you see an old lady that needs help with something. Maybe when she's not home, go fix it for her. When she comes home, she's just like, oh my God, starts believing in miracles. I can't believe it. This beautiful thing happened. Pick up hitchhikers, do good, be good, live by example, show, instead of spreading a lot of dark energy around these conspiracy and just pouring out awful facts about awful, awful things that just makes people want to hang themselves. Go out, show them that you can be one of these people that can take this kind of information, that can carry it on your shoulders, still in balance, in compassion, without letting anger and hate enter you. If you can do that, you will start seeing that you start spreading a beautiful energy around you. And once you do that, people will start listening to you instead of avoiding you. And then when they see you as somebody they respect, they will start following your example and they will start do good, spread good. And you will see in communities, it will start flourishing just like flowers. Give them water, give them sun, give them nourishment, the children, everything. You will see it start growing. Take care of each other in your neighborhood. See, instead of looking at the world saying, oh my God, we're going down. Absolutely not. We're not. We're just going through a difficult phase. So what can I do? Just like Kennedy said, don't ask what your country can do for you. What can you do for your country or the world or your family? What can you do? What can you give? Give without expecting. That is one of the major keys.
Wow, you should make tapes. You had me in a deep trance for a bit there. And I was thinking...
Oh, God. I hope that was positive.
No, it was great. And I hope this show goes viral.
Can I just say that my website is lightonconspiracies.com. Lightonconspiracies.com. Very handpicked name, because this is not Fight on Conspiracies or anything without... It's putting the spotlight right on this thing that we need to expose, because by exposing them, we can, in a totally non-violent way, make it stop. Once they cannot get away with these things that they have been repeating for such a long time, with all these sloppy false flag operations, assassinations and things, in such a incredibly sloppy way, the only reason they've been able to get away with it is because we have been totally brain dead and asleep. So as soon as we wake up and start seeing how they pull them off, how they do it, in what methods and so on, it won't work anymore. It's like watching Rambo or Rocky 1, 2, 3, 4. When you're seeing Rocky 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, when you're up in Rocky 32, you don't buy it anymore. You know that Rocky will come out as the winner in the end, and you know the whole thing. It doesn't matter what type of bad guy they come up with. It's the same story. It's the same here, same story, again and again and again. Expose them, and that will make a big part of stopping it.
Well, thank you so much for speaking like that to all of us, and for your energy and your courage and your kindness and your love. And thank you for being such a great human being, Ole. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sophia. And can I only say, if anyone wants to support me or the research or whatever I'm trying to accomplish, I'm going to do it anyway. But I'm extremely grateful for any type of financial support in the form of my newsletter, my membership area, books, donations, you name it. That is the thing that can help me focus on what I'm supposed to do and keep me not being distracted, because this is where I am. I'm having major problems focusing on these things. So by supporting me like that, because I'm doing it for all of us, it is an extremely appreciated gesture.
May I ask how much it is for membership for your newsletter? Is that what it is that you're doing?
No, I've done different my books. One is called Coup d'etat in slow motion, about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, but then with all the connections into the JFK assassination, the Iran-Contras, the pedophile gangs, the drug fighting, it's almost 1,100 pages, loads of names, photos, it's spot on. There's nothing like this is my theory, this is just like boom, 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 boom. Shadow of Tears is the book about my bicycle trip into Iran. And so on. I got one book called Remind Me. It is about how to remind yourself. It's a small power book. It takes you only like an hour to read, but it's the way I see the universe working and how you can help your mind to come to peace with what is going on and hopefully make yourself a better life. And then I've written one called Yolanda Yoga Panda. It's a children's book based on the Raja Yoga principles, the old ones. My membership area is €4.95 a month. And it's the same for my newsletter. That's €4.95 per month also. And so on.
Okay, well, I would say to people, if you enjoyed this show, got anything out of it, which I am absolutely sure you have, please do get something permanent and lasting from Ole Damgaard, because I've got to get that Shadow of Tears book. I have to read that. So that's something I can't bypass. So
and listen, can I also say that whatever, wherever, whenever I can make a difference for the better, count me in. Whenever, if it comes to public speaking or standing in the front of whatever account, nothing that has to do with violence, things or racism. Non-violent, I'm right there, up in front row, front line, whatever it takes. But also any type of interviews or radio shows or whatever, if you can get me there financially, if I can just get there, whatever country, wherever, I'm most open to do it.
Well, you have stated that intention, and that is exactly the way you're advising us all to be. We've got to put our intentions out and be willing, and we've got to give. So there you go. So once again, thank you so much for coming on my show, and I will stay in touch, and we'll do another someday.
Anytime, Sophia. It's been my absolute pleasure and honor to be on your show.
You're very welcome.